As you recall, honourable members, we had mandated Mr. Bassett to engage with officials or his counterparts in the Department of Home Affairs to see to what extent the laws administered by Home Affairs dealing with refugees and permanent and temporary residents will be impacted upon by the trafficking bill. So I'm going to ask Mr. Bassett to just brief us on those discussions and how far they've gone and what we can expect.
I don't know, I should raise it with you beforehand, but this email campaign on the trafficking bill, I know you did a statement, but and unfortunately there don't seem to be any trafficking organizations or anti-trafficking organizations here.
Is there?
Oh, okay. But Chair, the difficulty is, I mean, there's a lot of people are largely sending the same email, but the two things that worry me is, one, they keep appealing to the minister. The bill is with Parliament, so to be fair to the minister, it's nothing to do with him at the moment. And in terms of the separation of powers, to expect him to instruct Parliament to finalise the bill would be unconstitutional. Secondly, a lot of the content of the emails sort of assumes that there's no anti-trafficking legislation, which is not correct, and people have been fed the wrong information that it is illegal to traffic for sexual purposes and children. That's already on our statute books, and I just wish there was some way of getting this information out. I mean, it's all very well to run a campaign, but it's just, you look at these emails and you think, well, people clearly don't know what's going on. And then I think the other aspect that I am interested in is, as you know, the committee is interested in the progress of trafficking cases and where there are problems. Some of the emails have alluded to existing cases. I would be interested in following up what is happening with those cases for those people to supply us with the information of case numbers and things like that. Because, Chair, as far as I know, as it stands at the moment, there is sufficient domestic law on trafficking for sexual purposes and for children, not for labour trafficking, but the other two are adequately covered at the moment.
Now, Mr. Jeffrey, you make an important point, and those points were raised very early in our deliberations, when the NPA pointed out to us that, notwithstanding the fact that we didn't have legislation that sought to prevent and combat trafficking, existing law was being effectively used, and we were provided with cases to that effect. I think the points you raise are valid. Myself, I mean, I'm not afraid to admit this, when I see those emails, I delete them. I don't even go to the extent of honoring them by opening them and reading them. Because, as you say, they all say the same thing. And don't really add to the discourse in any way. But if there are other honourable members that want to add to what Mr. Jeffrey said, let me hear you now. Mr. Swart.
Yeah, thank you. I think that one might want to address a letter from the church just setting out. I think you've done it already.
To whom do I send it?
Does one not have a list of the organisations that made submissions? Just to say, look, we appreciate your concerns, but there is existing legislation, and so that we can, maybe then in so doing, then there's better knowledge in the broader context. I don't know if it's a plausible But
I look at it.
Maybe we can consider something like that. Thank you, Chair. And then asking if there are, if there's specific cases like the Honourable Jeffries referred to, of that we would like to be aware of those specific cases. That might be one way of dealing with it.
Advocate Holomisa, sir.
Chair, I don't know if it can help to be responding to this petition, because they will keep on doing this until the deal is finalized. And we just have to continue with our program as planned and see that it is finalized, because it's our in our interest that we finalize it ourselves. There's nothing to do. I also get emails on a continuous basis besides this, from people who say I must stop the killing of the bull in KwaZulu-Natal.
There you go.
Every day. I once tried to respond and I just come and know.
The bull.
You know, some of us, when we are supposed to say L, we said R, and then the other way around.
I'll tell you a funny story one day about the L and the R. All right. Mr. Bassett?
Thank you very much, Chair. Just before I start, Louisa Steemon isn't been able to join us today, but she'll be at the next lot, so I apologise on her behalf. As you said, Chair, we were mandated to go and talk to our colleagues at the Department of Home Affairs. I emailed some documents yesterday, and one of the documents is a discussion note that was prepared for purposes of our meeting with Home Affairs. Unfortunately, I think there was a hitch on the side. Server was down or something, so that document didn't come through, but I understand Mr. Romano's having it copied. Maybe just by way of background, I think the concerns, just to give you an idea of what the concerns of Home Affairs are, questions were raised, for instance, would a genuine victim of trafficking, once that person has been rescued or found in South Africa, not want to return to his or her country of origin at the first available opportunity? And if that's the case, why do we need provisions to allow these people to stay? They will want to go back if they are genuine victims of trafficking. Another question that comes to mind, I'm telling you this because that's where I assume Home Affairs is coming from. If a victim is required for police investigation or prosecution purposes, even then the question seems to be, why don't we as a country send the person back, and when the case is trial ready, let the person come back? Is there not another question that came up, is there not a danger in allowing persons to allege that they are victims of trafficking? Would it not be more appropriate for police officials to present persons as victims of trafficking to the relevant authorities who the police come across during the course of the investigation? So I think these are the questions that Home Affairs is grappling with. Anyway, we had this meeting, and unfortunately the people that were at the meeting told us right at the outset they're not in a position to take decisions, and they would have to take this matter to their senior management. We then tried to organise, but anyway, what came out of the meeting, at least they know where we're coming from. The provisions that we really discussed were the three provisions, the recovery and reflection period, clause 21 in the bill as it is now, temporary residence or visitor's permit, clause 22 and 23's permanent residence. We told them at the outset that it would seem as if the committee, as far as permanent residence is concerned, or when a person cannot be returned to his or her country, that the committee is thinking along the lines of doing away with that clause. A person that can't go back to his or her country will have to apply for refugee status. So that was discussed, said to them right up front. This document that we prepared, we also tried to set out South Africa's international obligations and the provisions of the protocol, and making it very clear that Article 7, for instance, says that state parties in implementing Article 7, which provides that each state party shall consider adopting legislative or other appropriate measures that permit victims of trafficking in persons to remain in its territory temporarily or permanently in appropriate cases, and that the protocol also says that in implementing this provision, each state party shall give appropriate consideration to humanitarian and compassionate factors. So we try to point out that the reasoning why these provisions are in the bill, the importance of recovery and reflection period, that this legislation is not only about protecting victims but also facilitating successful prosecutions, and without the witnesses or the victims being here, those cases would just not happen. We pointed out to them possible amendments to the existing clauses, and if I take you through the amendments that we have in mind, which we haven't really discussed in the committee, but these are amendments that Home Affairs is going to have a look at in the course of their further discussions. In clause 21, the recovery and reflection period, we've suggested, and that's still for consideration by the committee, to try and emphasize in clause 21 what the recovery and reflection period is about. So clause 21 could read, and let me just quote, despite the provisions of the Immigration Act, the Director General Home Affairs must, in a prescribed manner and subject to the prescribed conditions, allow a foreigner who has been issued with a letter of recognition, regardless of his or her status, to remain in the Republic for a non-renewable recovery and reflection period not exceeding 90 days. And then to add the following wording. I'm using the one there. The heading is discussion note. And it's on page 15. And you'll see the what is being tabled for the consideration of the committee is the wording and shading, that the wording that has been shaded. So the DG Home Affairs will issue a letter of recognition so that the person can remain in the country for the purposes of accessing the programs referred to in section 26, with the view to enabling the foreigner to make informed decisions regarding his or her cooperation with law enforcement and prosecuting authorities in the investigation and prosecution of a case of trafficking. So that's just for consideration, for the committee's consideration, and the officials at Home Affairs will also have a look at that. Then, as far as the temporary residence is concerned, we made it very clear that these people aren't going to stay, victims aren't going to stay in the country for a long time, and that the purpose of the temporary residence permit is purely for investigation and prosecution purposes. Mm-hmm. And to try and strengthen that argument and make it clearer in the bill, if you go to page 18 of the that document, we've proposed an amendment to clause 22, which deals with temporary residence, and let me read it. It reads, despite the provisions of section 11(1) of the Immigration Act, a visitor's permit may, and we suggest, on the request of the Provincial Commissioner of the South African Police or the Director of Public Prosecutions having jurisdiction, be issued to a victim of trafficking, and a similar wording is inserted in subclause 2, so that the request for a person, for a witness to stay in the country for these purposes comes from a senior functionary, written a request that is the Provincial Commissioner of SAPS and the relevant Director of Public Prosecutions, and it's purely for the purpose of staying in the country for those purposes. So Home Affairs indicated that they would have a look at that in the course of their discussions. We also, and we have discussed this in the committee on a previous occasion, suggested amendment to the Refugees Act, Section 3, and that is because we were of the view that the qualification for refugee status would invariably exclude a victim of trafficking, because if you have a look at page 22, where Section 3 of the Refugees Act is set out, a person qualifies for refugee status for the purposes of this Act, and I'll just mention a few examples, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted by reason of his or her race, tribe, religion, nationality, political opinion, etc., or membership of a particular social group is outside of his country and is unable to go back, or it's owing to external aggression. Those are the factors that are that qualify a person for being a refugee status. And we possibly in our innocence suggested an amendment that to make specific provision for victims of trafficking. Home Affairs are very against this. And I think I can see why. They said if you put a criteria like this in, it's going to open the floodgates and that should be avoided at all costs. They did say to us that a victim of trafficking could possibly fall under one of the criteria in Section 3A is being membership of a particular social group. I'm not too sure whether that would be the case. They say unfortunately there's been no case law on this to test it, but that's what they did say to us. In this document, we did go through other provisions of the Refugees Act, set those out, and the Immigration Act, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I think what came out in the meeting that we had with Home Affairs was the possibility of using section, if I can just find it, section 31 of the Immigration Act. That could be possibly used as it exists, as it reads now, or they also said to us that there could be a possibility of amending those provisions to suit our needs. Section 31 deals with exemptions. 31 of the Immigration Act deals with exemptions. That you can find that on page 11 of your document, and provides, I quote, upon application, the minister may, under terms and conditions determined by him or her, grant a foreigner or category of foreigners the rights of permanent residence for a specified or unspecified period when special circumstances exist which would justify such a decision. And Home Affairs said that is a possibility. We told them, and we've got documentation here, that the NPA has said to us that they've tried to use that provision in the past for witnesses that they have, not only in trafficking cases but in other cases as well. And they say it really just in practice it takes too long, it does not work, it's just not a viable option. We mentioned that to Home Affairs and they said they would take that into consideration when they go back and discuss the issue. So Section 31(2) of the Immigration Act is a strong possibility to be used either as it is or possibly with amendments. It could be used for prosecution and investigation purposes, and Home Affairs even went as far as to say that provision could even be used if a person applies for refugee status and doesn't get it for some or other reason. So the person that cannot doesn't want to go back to his or her own country can then apply to the minister for this exemption in Section 32, 31(2). So that was the gist of our discussions. We try to make clear why we've got these provisions and to say that we are prepared to make adjustments to suit them if it would help, or otherwise they must have a look at that, what they can do, and they're going to come back to us. And I spoke to the people at Home Affairs again yesterday saying that we would be in the committee today, and saying, asking them whether they've had any feedback from their senior management. They have unfortunately not been able to do that. The people that they need to talk to are apparently, lots of them are out of the country and will only be back on Monday, and I was given an indication, hopefully, that the internal discussion in Home Affairs will possibly take place Tuesday next week. It was also made very clear that they're in the process of revising policy, coming up with new policy, and I get a sense that they're in the middle of that, and that's why it's making it difficult for them. I think that in a nutshell is what I can report back. Thank you, Chair.
All right. The Honourable Steve Swart, followed by the Honourable Andrew Sini.
Yeah, this bill was filed at the beginning of last year. We've had this discussion. It went through Cabinet. The Home Affairs Minister was at Cabinet and approved the bill. We then had discussions. We've been making progress. Our last meeting was on the 7th of September, where certain issues were raised, and I think, Chair, you indicated the Minister had personally phoned you, said it was an urgent intervention. We expressed our objections, but we, as to the whole issue of Cabinet approval, and we remember we had that short discussion, but we appreciated that there was a need for further consultation. And we were given to understand that it would not take too long, a question of a few weeks. Now, 2 months down the line, we're back at a situation where there's still going to be considered, and I'm not, Mr. Bassett, it's not against you, but it's just unacceptable that the Home Affairs cannot tell us exactly what their position is. That's very clear. You put options, and we the legislatures, and maybe we should just continue. Because the problem is, we're now talking about a revising of the whole policy, and this could extend the matter indefinitely. And we complain about emails coming, then we'll see the emails coming. So I'm a bit concerned, Chair, about the open-endedness of these discussions with Home Affairs. And I would like some guidance as to putting deadlines, specific deadlines, in place so that we could finalise this. Legislation, by its very nature, is difficult to say when we're going to finalise it. But I think we've got one department now that is. It seems that there hasn't been consultation at a sufficiently higher level to take decisions. And it's now 2 months down the track. So, Chair, I just wanted to express my objections and concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, the issue of the amendment of the Refugee Act. I think we need to take cognizance of what Home Affairs has said. The system of refugee affairs, more than many other fields, is one in which the integration between international law and municipal law, domestic law, it's almost absolute. There is a system, the grounds are spelled out in the 1951 Geneva Convention, and it's well-found fear of, I mean, the one you mentioned, well-found fear of persecution on the grounds of race, political opinions, etc., religion. We can't add something else to the train because the system will reject it, the UN High Commission for Refugee would reject it. So I agree. The second thing, the exception, the Section 31, that is an extraordinary power, is used as an extraordinary power with the minister. It used to be Section 26 of the Aliens Control Act. It goes through an enormous amount of internal checks and balances within the department because it was abused. And there is always a concern to be abused. Basically, it's an action by the minister which tells the person the law doesn't matter. It's very restricted. It could not and it should not be the vehicle through which an entire category, in spite of the language, is taken care of. And I think that there will be resistance within the department to do that. Third, Mr. Chairman, we had here other organs of state. I think we should have the Department of Home Affairs here before us so we can interrogate their concern the same way as we've done with the NPA. The NPA suggested amendments. We were given the opportunity to discuss them with the NPA. Here we are receiving some amendments to the very good offices, very praiseworthy work of Mr. Bassett, but still we don't have his interlocutor before us. I would like to point to one aspect which emerged from the concern of the department, which is an echoing theme in the department. This will open the floodgates. We need to ask ourselves whether there is a flood, and the indication, yes, there is a flood. And that's the concern, which I think is a legitimate concern, is that once there is a new vehicle which in any way stops deportation and require further investigation before a person can be removed from the Republic, the vehicle will be used by people seeking to remain in the country against a personal backdrop of absolute desperation, terrible conditions of many of these illegal foreigners that one must sympathize with. The same way as a huge number of people became immediately familiar with the complexities of the refugee acts and procedures, to the point of having collapsed the entire system of refugee control, the concern exists that the same may happen when this opportunity arises, and many people do not qualify for the benefit, will claim to qualify for the benefit, and will stay in the Republic pending the certification, pending the what happens, the investigation to be conducted in different countries. I suspect that faced with that, the Department would like to have the summary power to send everyone back and then investigate later. And I think that this is the difficulty we have. The rationale of this bill is don't deport, investigate, make a finding, and then you send them back if they don't qualify, which is akin to the refugee affair scheme. But the Department, from what emerges, would wish, the Department of Home Affairs would wish to send them back, and then if the circumstances warrant it, bring them back. I don't know how one squared this circle, but that concern is, in my humble opinion, one that we must listen to, but we cannot listen to the solution they are proposing because it would defeat the purpose of the bill.
The Honourable Mr. Jeffrey, followed by the Honourable Schaefer.
Dr. Ambrosini is being unusually constructive. But just to follow on from him, I mean, it is a complicated, I mean, he obviously knows from his time as advisor to the Minister of Home Affairs, he knows the Home Affairs issues, and it's been useful, I think, getting his perspective, because I think it is a complicated issue. We have a inordinately high number of refugees in South Africa. I'd read somewhere, I don't know if it's accurate, that we have the sort of highest number of, one of the highest numbers of refugees in the world. And that then manifests itself, if it's not properly dealt with xenophobic violence, where people feel that refugees are getting access to resources that they should have got. So we do need to deal with the issue sensitively, and the bill should not become a vehicle for people who have not been trafficked to argue that they were trafficked and therefore gain rights to stay. The issue that and then I think that we, in our innocence as the committee, I mean, I hear Dr. Ambrosini's points on the Refugees Act and the international processes. In our innocence as the committee, we were the ones who proposed linking it to the Refugee Act, which it seems is not appropriate. The key issue we've got to address is the aspect of people who. And it would be a single category of traffic victims. I think if somebody has been trafficked here, then, you know, why should they stay? The fact that you were trafficked should not give you a right to stay permanently in the Republic. The category I think we should be providing for is those people who can assist in the prosecution of trafficking crimes and basically as witnesses. I don't think it is feasible to expect those people to go home and then come back, because why should they come back?
Sure.
And we have an interest in the country in the people responsible for trafficking being prosecuted. So we need to provide for victims of trafficking who are going to be used as witnesses to stay in the country until they have given evidence. That's the one category we need to provide for. Then, down the line, as it were, we also need to provide for victims of trafficking who have given evidence, and objectively, because of that evidence, they do not feel safe in their country of origin. It may be a developing country, there may be syndicates and crime syndicates may be strong. That was the category we were looking at with the Refugees Act, which I don't think covers it. I mean, for example, I was going to use the example of the Italian Mafia, but after Dr. Ambrosini's positive input, I'll use the Colombian drug lords. A person who has assisted the police with the prosecution of Colombian drug lords in Colombia does not have a right, as far as I can see, to come to South Africa and claim refugee status. Their life is in danger in Colombia because they gave evidence against these drug lords, but I don't see them fitting into any of the categories in the Refugees Act. Now, it may be that section of the Immigration Act may be, or it may be the Immigration Act is the appropriate body. I hear Dr. Ambrosini's concerns and it is in any way the there's documentation from the NPA that system is quite cumbersome at the moment, and you want a position where the prosecutors can say to potential witness whose evidence is quite crucial and who would be in danger if they went home, if they testify, the prosecutors need to be able to say to that witness, we will enable you to stay here, and be able to give a response within a short period so that witness can then make up their mind, are they prepared to then testify. So I do think we've got to do some amendment, but it may be then more appropriate that it's to the Immigration Act, but it's specifically with regards to trafficking. I would have felt that to safeguard, to tighten things, that in both cases that I've mentioned, the person who's going to be used as a witness and the person who then has testified or is going to testify, you know, so the first category is the investigation is still going on, you don't know, your case is going to be in maybe 6 months' time at the best, probably a year's time, you don't know who you're going to use as a witness. So it's a broader category, and I would have argued with that category, it's provision for temporary residents or to stay in the country rather. Temporary residents is not necessarily the right word, but those people need to be able to stay in the country on a temporary basis, and that's a wider group of people. But it is for the purposes of contributing to the criminal investigation, not necessarily testifying, but contributing to the criminal investigation. And that category, I think Mr. Bassett is proposing that the application is made by the Provincial Commissioner of Police. Whether that's the appropriate person, I mean, that's high level. I think the safeguard for us is that it's a very senior law enforcement official. Whether it's the police or whether it should be the NPA, I think we need to look at. But they make the application rather than anyone else. Then it's they're able to say, because it would be to Home Affairs, they're able to say to Home Affairs, look, we're at a senior level, we believe this person's presence is necessary in the country to assist us for these and these reasons. The second category of the people who then will never be able to go home, that I think should be NPA, who make that application on their behalf. But I think that we do need to address those two categories of people. The recovery reflection period would stay. I mean, it's a short period. I know Home Affairs are worried that anyone who's about to be deported can then say, okay, actually I was trafficked, and then they're entitled to that period. But I think it would, Dr. Ambrosini's suggestion about getting Home Affairs here, I think is a very useful one, and I think maybe that is the way to go, to request Home Affairs to come here. Chair, we would need to invite the Home Affairs Portfolio Committee. But I think when Home Affairs come here, to have the Hawks, who are, I think, the main policing body involved in the investigation of trafficking matters, and the NPA present as well, to respond, because it's basically, as far as I can see, we are trying to address the police and the NPA's concerns to enable them to have a successful prosecution.
Honourable David Sheik.
actually all three previous speakers. I mean, I think it is unacceptable that 2 months later there was an urgent intervention by the minister to deal with the Home Affairs issues. If it was so urgent and so important, we would have expected that the officials engaging with Mr. Bassett would have had the required authority to agree to whatever needs to be agreed to. And I think that's Dr. Ambrosini's suggestion is the way we should go. We need to call Home Affairs to come here as soon as we can, agree on a date as soon as possible. And I think that's correct. We have the NPA and the Hawks here so that we can, any objections that are raised from either angle can be dealt with straight away at the same meeting, so we can try and finalize it. Thanks.
All right.
There must be people with authority to be able to agree to amendments and to come with proposals as to how they see us accommodating our concerns as well as theirs.
All right. Fair enough. JJ?
No, it's fine, but I think if Mr. Bassett, I don't know if the rest of the committee agrees with me, that there's three categories.
Yeah.
There's the reflection period, which applies to everybody, which you need, but how do you have safeguards? I mean, it is very short. Maybe the fact that it's so short means that it can be wide. And then the two categories that I'm primarily concerned about is the people who the law enforcement agencies need or may need to assist them with their investigations, that they are allowed to stay on a temporary basis. They need to be accommodated. And then the other category is those persons who have testified, who, because of their testimony, their lives are in danger in their country of origin and would not be able to return, and they would need provision to be able to stay here permanently.
I think you've got that discussed. Mr. Emerson.
A corollary which I think we need to be aware of. One of the categories of people who are identified as victim of trafficking are those who are placed in the position of being illegal foreigners, and they cannot go back to their country of origin, because in their country of origin there is absolute misery, no food, no nothing. So no matter how terrible the conditions are while they're being trafficked, they still prefer to be there. And that's a condition of trafficking. Now, in respect of those people, it becomes very difficult for them to come forward and disclose their condition and accuse those who place them in those conditions if that means that they are going to be deported. And that's what the Palermo Protocol addresses when it says the victim of trafficking needs to be able to stay. So, and that goes to JJ's comments that the reflection period should be a short one. There we got the aspect of compliance with the protocol, which is a necessary one. And there is the possibility of abuse. I mean, I've been exposed to some of these people who travel the whole of Africa to come here. And telling you, some of them will do anything to remain here rather than having to go back in conditions where their survival is very precarious. And I don't know, and this is what concerns me as a legislator, whether we are not encouraging some of these people to become victims of crime. I'm going to be a prostitute for 3 months and then I get to stay. And these are all the things we need to put together, and I'm not sure how they come together, but we need to be alive and aware of these difficulties.
I'm going to pose a question before I recognize you, Mr. Jeffrey. I always thought it was more or less the same, but what is the difference between deportation and repatriation? If you're able to answer, Mr. Bassett, or your team. Because the point the Minister of Home Affairs makes is that, and it's a relevant one, that we need to bear in mind. It's a normal human natural thing that if you're forcibly removed from your family, that you'd want to go back home to your family. when you read the bill, it sounds as though this person has been trafficked. We're now welcoming them into South Africa to stay. No consideration that this person wants to return to their family and their home.
Mr. Bassett? I might be able to answer part of that question. Deport or deportation in terms of the Immigration Act means in the definition clause the action or procedure aimed at causing an illegal foreigner, to leave the Republic in terms of this act. So that's deportation. Thank you. Depart, there's also definition of depart in the Immigration Act means exiting the Republic from a port of entry in compliance with this Act, and then we've dealt with deport. Repatriation isn't dealt with in the Act. I think it's a generic that is probably used quite loosely, but we can go into that further. I don't have an answer on that.
Check the Oxford Dictionary. Mr. Jeffrey.
I see the word repatriation is used in the Palermo Protocol, and I would have seen it as deportation is an involuntary process. You're illegal, therefore you are sent back. Repatriation, maybe voluntary, it's not this, it's wider than that, it's the return. But Chair, the point I just wanted to point out was Article 7 of Palermo. I mean, we do need to avoid a situation, and it's the issue, it's been there, and it's something I think that we've addressed considerably in the bill, correcting, the situation in a country may be so bad that economically you cannot survive. You then become a victim of labor trafficking, and you should not be in a position where you can argue that no, if you go back, you're just going to get trafficked again because there's no employment. I mean, we will just have too many refugees if that is the case. I mean, not refugees, too many people. If you look at some of our neighboring countries, the situation in Swaziland is not too hot. So you don't want a situation where people in Swaziland accept employment, which is effectively labor trafficking. Not for sexual purposes, but for other forms of labour, and then say, well, we are not going back because we've got no work there, we're starving. Unfortunately, I mean, although that is a very bad humanitarian problem, well, let's take Somalia. I mean, there people are really starving. We can't take every Somali in our country, but I just point out Article 7, which deals with this, the status of victims of trafficking of persons in receiving states, is quite vague. It's not very restrictive. Each state party shall consider adopting legislative or other appropriate measures that permit victims of trafficking in persons to remain in its territory. So it's basically a requirement that it must be looked at, not that it must be done. And I think we need to be clear on that. So Chair, to my mind, I think the category of people that for a person to allege that they need to stay here, I'm not sympathetic. Looking at the broader position of the country and the resources and things like that, I'm not that sympathetic to people who want to argue that they can't go back because they'll get trafficked again because things are so dire in their country. To my mind, it's the category of persons who are going to assist in criminal investigations to root out people responsible for trafficking. Mr. Bassett.
Yeah, just to confirm what Mr. Jeffrey says on that discussion note, I did that has just been circulated. When I dealt with Article 7 on page 3, you'll see there it says, although this article does not place an obligation on state parties to adopt legislative or other appropriate measures that permit victims of traffic to remain in their countries, they cannot from the outset decide not to adopt such measures. State parties will have to show that they've given serious consideration to the adoption of such measures and should be able to explain why none of the measures have been adopted or can be adopted. So, yeah, just to confirm what was said there. Give consideration to adopting legislative measures, not making you adopt the legislative measures.
Okay. Honourable Debbie Schaefer?
It also specifically says temporarily or permanently, so it doesn't oblige us to keep them here forever.
No. All right.
Yeah, may I just get clarity on our responsibility? We've got sort of guidelines now of what we must look at. Should we go back and prepare something, or should we wait for the discussion with Home Affairs?
You did indicate that you were hoping to meet with them early next week. I think you must proceed with that meeting. In the meantime, we will engage with either the Minister or the DG and arrange for the appropriately senior person. I was going to say qualified, but authorized. Thank you to come and address us. The Honourable John Jeffrey.
I think what also, I mean, there has been some discussion from the committee now, which I think has sort of focused the committee's position more, and I think it is basically, look, it was what I was proposing, but no one was disagreeing or really adding. Those categories of persons. So you've got, for example, at the moment, the category that's allowed to stay temporarily, that application must be made by the police commissioner provincial. Is that appropriate? Should it be the NPA? You may want to approach the NPA. And then I think it's generally agreed, although there wasn't that much discussion, that we drop the Refugees Act route as inappropriate for the points that Dr. Ambrosini raised. So it would then be going to an amendment to the Immigration Act or some provision that specifically allows an expeditious provision. It can be on request of the minister, but it is for trafficked victims who, because of their testimony, who can argue that they are unable to return to their country of origin because their life would be in danger because of the support that they have their testimony. And that application, I think, should be made by the NPA. It could be the national director delegated. I think just look more at that and whether that's an amendment to the Immigration Act that we then put as a proposal to Home Affairs, who administer that act.
Also remembering that Section 31 sub 2 might also assist us to some degree of the Immigration Act.
Yeah.
All right. So what else is there, Mr. Bassett?
Perhaps I could just give you general feedback where we are otherwise. After, I think, our last meeting was the 6th of September, and we got various instructions from the committee, among others, to start cleaning up the bill, which we've done. We've taken out the provisions where the committee has given clear instructions and cleaned up from that point of view. We've taken out footnotes where the discussions on those issues have
been finalised.
What remains in the document are, and the amendments that are in the document are the amendments that were, or that the instructions that we were given on the 6th of September, and also areas in respect of which the committee still needs to make decisions, and the footnotes are all there. And we distributed that document on the 9th of September to all the role-playing departments. We've had no feedback, really, from those departments. That document I emailed through to Mr. Romano yesterday. I think it is available. So that's the document that you've got there, and be in a position to start discussing it if the committee would want to do that. What else do I need to say? And then there are two other documents that were made available this morning. They were also emailed yesterday. Unfortunately, they never came through. The one we've already discussed is the discussion document on the Home Affairs issues. Then there's a document... Engler Stein did some research. We were requested to have a look at legislation of other countries on mandatory reporting of victims of trafficking, focusing on adults. There is information that is contained in that document. Engelo can take you through it. We were hoping to get more specific information from there are some African countries there that was good that we were able to get, but we wanted to get some other countries in Commonwealth countries, UK, Canada, New Zealand. We battled a bit there, but there is information in the document. And Engelo also, we also worked through our International Affairs Department to see if we could get further information, and that takes a bit longer. We're hoping to get some more information, but there is information in the document that has been circulated. Then there's a document on penalty provisions. Department was requested to try and come up with a document having a with reference to the proposals made by the NPA. I think the committee raised some reservations or concerns about the particularly high penalty clauses, the fines, and asked us to have a look at that and come back with possible other proposals. We've got a document to that effect. We can take you through that. Chair, I think that's what I'd like to say in general, and we'd like your guidance on how you'd like, what you want to do. Sorry, Jim, I also just, you asked us to speak to the NPA about the poker provisions, prevention of organized crime. We've resolved that as well, and that's contained in the footnote. The AFU Asset Forfeiture Unit has said possibly we must leave that Clause 30A, declaration of forfeiture provisions, and we will deal with that when we get to that provision. There's quite a lengthy footnote on that.
Okay, very good. Mr.
Emerson? Just a quick question. What's the difference between the deleted by bolding and square bracketed and the deleted by striking out?
We have that. We spoke about that internally as well. I suppose they should really all be... Yeah, that is useful because the square brackets and underlining sort of tells you that was the first round of deletions of the bill that was introduced, and the strike throughs happened at a later stage.
All right. Okay. Are you able to remind me where we left off on the bill itself? Which clause?
Chair, we on the 6th of September we went right through to the end of May, and so. I'm not too sure where you want to start today.
Mr. Jeffrey and Mr. Swart?
My suggestion would be that we don't go through the bill again.
Right.
We have to still do that before we finalise it. But the aim is to get the bill into a position that we can, at the penultimate sitting, go through it and approve the amendments. So what you should focus on is the issues that require further discussion. So they would have been the issues that came up last time that you've done some work on, and the issues where the committee was unsure.
You're fine, Mr. Swart? Right, fine. Okay, so then what do we do today?
We will then go through the bill and try and highlight the areas that still need decisions, and there are places here and there that we've taken the initiative and made some changes. We'll try and bring those to your attention where we think changes are necessary, and ask Engelo to help us there. Before Engelo starts, the first one she pointed out is really on the front page. The committee said it would like to take a decision on the short title of the bill, but maybe that we should leave until the end as well.
Well, let's leave it until
the
end. Point of order, can we make sure we're all on the same version? Is this the October 27?
That's correct.
October 27th.
Where's
the date? Where's
right the date?
Oh,
goodness, okay.
Tip working document with instructions of PC on 6 September, version 27 October.
Oh, version 27 October. All right, fine. I've got it now. Sure, it's very small. Okay. yeah, I think just see if everyone has got that copy, and make sure they have it in their possession. Do we have enough copies? There's someone here that needs a copy. Under that clipboard, I think. Let's check there.
Can I start?
Please.
On page 6 of the working document, the committee will note there's a footnote 7 regarding whether we should keep Schedule 2 to the bill.
I know the title we're going to come back to, but it's a question of what are the options, at least to focus our minds. I noticed from the comparative table of penalties, which refers to a number of different laws, it's sort of weird the names that they're given. I mean, we have prevention and combating trafficking, Kenya is counter-trafficking, Zambia is anti-human trafficking, Egypt is the law regarding combating, Nigeria's trafficking persons prohibition law, and India's the Immoral Traffic Prevention Act. So I just, but I don't know, before we move from that footnote, how are we going to, yes, it's not unusual if we deal with broader things like that at the end, but can we, do we have a list of options?
Well, have you?
No, I'm fine with, I can't remember what the problem was.
Well, that's, I can't recall who raised it as a problem, actually. All right, let's move on and we'll...
Can we just hear, they put the footnote on, can we hear what they recall, why they put the footnote on? Somebody must have raised it.
Yes. Who raised it? What we can do is go and have a look in the summary of comments that was prepared. I'm sure it comes out there.
In my notes, there's one, the proposal was raised with someone said that it should be prevention and protection of victims and combating of trafficking in persons.
Oh, no.
That was the something which was raised at the previous public hearing.
No, no, that's unwieldy and off. Well, we'll put it down as an option and you can decide, but it sounds like.
Unless anybody from the committee is supporting that, just to reduce our work and make progress, can't we just leave it as it is and drop a footnote?
All right. Okay. So the footnote comes out. Anything on page 2? You were saying on page 6?
On page 6,
right.
You will note footnote 7. The UNODC cautions against the inclusion of the protocol as a schedule to the bill, as it could open the state to litigation if anything in the bill is inadvertently in conflict with the provisions of the protocol. This is something that the committee still needs to decide.
Sorry? The schedule out?
Maybe can I ask where does the, I mean, the protocol schedule 2, where is it referred to in the bill?
What's the link between Schedule 2 and the bill?
And the bill itself. I think. And it's really there for information purposes. Right on page 11, UN protocol means the UN protocol, especially an, the English text of which is replicated in Schedule 2. And we did that for the International Criminal Court, and it really is for information purposes. And we might be advised to follow what the UN committee is suggesting.
So it's their suggestion, and they're saying take it out, yes. The Honourable Debbie Schaefer, followed by Dr. Ambrosini.
I just ask, is there anything that we know of that is in conflict with it, just as a matter of interest? No.
Part of the certification process, and Ms. Williams must probably be able to help us. I say there's nothing, but I think that was looked at during the certification process specifically as well.
Maybe before that.
Yes, I see that the footnote 7 is and it's underlined. You know, UNODC cautions against the inclusion if anything is inadvertently. So I think it's the issue of there's no conflict that anyone is aware of, but there might be inadvertently, and in law there always is that case. So I would feel if I mean the protocol exists, it stands alone. Why have it in the bill then, if particularly if there's this recommendation from the UNODC?
Yeah, and it would have come as a result of experiences in other jurisdictions as well.
I don't have any objection to take it out of the bill. I don't foresee any thing prohibiting that.
All right. Comes out, honourable members?
Yeah.
Good.
This paper that'll be used.
Well, we've used so much already, Mr. Bassett, I'm not sure it'll matter that much. Okay, so we've taken that decision.
Still on page 6. You will note there the definition of abuse of vulnerability. It originally read, for purposes of the definition of trafficking, means any abuse, and then it goes on. But the definition of trafficking was basically taken out of the definitions section and is now found in section 4.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we have amended the wording there to refer then for purposes of section 4, and then what follows.
That's for information. There's no decision
yet. Yes. The definition of accredited organization, on the 6th of September, the committee recommended that the word facility rather than organization be used, so that was deleted.
The chairman?
Yes, Dr. Anderson.
Consequential 24, it still refers to an organization.
20?
Clause 24.
Why have you jumped to 24?
Because we...
Okay.
Yeah. Just make a note when we get there.
Yes, I can just maybe explain that the numbering of the clauses are not final, so we will check that.
That's not my point. My point is that we changed the word organization to facility in the definition and not reflected in the body.
Okay.
Oh, good point. Thank you. Yes. It should read accreditation of facilities, eh?
Yes.
Well, although the definition does refer to accredited organization.
Yes.
All right, we'll have to think about that. Mr. Jeffrey.
Why do we need this definition? I mean, I've got a little bit of a problem with, I know the debate that we had last time around organization, government organization is limited and there would be bodies that are not government organizations. I'm not quite sure what a facility is, whether there's legal certainty. But I'm then just looking at Clause 24, which is the accreditation of organizations and sets out the whole procedure. Why do we need this definition? And if we have the definition, if you want to Then why can it just not be accredited organization? Means an organization referred to in accredited in terms of section 24.
I think the debate in the past was that we want to emphasize the fact that the accredited organizations are not just NGOs.
No, we know that. Yeah. But it's a question of should you not put that detail in clause 24,
okay.
Rather than in a one-liner in the definition. Yeah. And then it's section 24 that has the detail of the accredited organization.
Sorry.
And the definition just simply refers to it.
All right.
So I don't know if there's any consequential amendment that you need to put that it can be a government facility. It also means you've got more space to define what the government facility is. Because as I said, I'm a little bit, I don't know if any of my colleagues have the problem, what is a facility? I mean, is it a playing field? No, but I mean, it could be. You know, that's not what's intended, but it's just, is that the right word? I mean, a facility is a Tusong center, is a creche. It's an object. You mean it's a what was intended? I mean, because I think SASA is not a department. It's an agency. So I think it was trying to go broader. I don't think it was SASA that we were referring to. I can't remember what it is. But I'm just worried that facility sounds odd. Facility for me is a material thing, like a structure.
It was that exact thing. I mean, we were saying, like Tusong centers, for example, maybe we could use a Tusong center. Maybe we could use, you know, there might be something that is run by non-NGO bodies, but it's not a department. That is what we were trying to say. So if that's not the correct word, then that may be a problem. But, I mean, we were trying to provide for facilities that might be run semi, maybe even partly by the state. But it's not not necessarily a department.
I think they need more work on it, but I think that my suggestion of dealing with it in clause 24, where you're not limited by the space that you're entitled to, the space limitations that you have in a definition, means that you can be a bit clearer. But obviously, don't go overboard and give us a 5-page reference, but something that the minister has. I mean, it's the minister who's accrediting. And that they may include government departments or government funded bodies. I don't know if body is the right word.
Because I mean, at Tucson Center,
you can't accredit a physical structure. It would be the management committee that's running that, the legal entity.
Yeah. All right. So we're actually looking for a definition of facility.
And in clause 24, we'll go and give some thought to that if we may.
All right.
What is it? I'm trying to think, what does this this current formulation take away from what is intended? Even the Tusong centers, they have facilities which have management, of course. And when you're referring to Tusong centers, you're referring to the people running those facilities, obviously. Yeah. We're not referring to structures, walls, and so on. So I'm trying to think what is it, because obviously there was a reason why, in the course of our discussions, the department felt we needed to formulate it in this way. Besides the fact that, obviously, we wanted to make it clear from the definition itself that organizations are not necessarily non-governmental institutions that are referred to. Hence, in certain instances, this service has to be provided by a government institution or facility. What it does about having had these discussions and getting the department to come with formulations which reflect what we discussed, only to send them back again just because maybe we don't remember what it is that we said.
Mm.
But the point would be, Chair, is this taking anything away?
Well, Gamzee, I'm not in a position to answer you.
I don't know how to address it directly.
Sure. Can you help?
Maybe it's addressed to the chair and to the committee. I mean, my worry is the word facility correct? Is that the best word? Because you tend to think of the structure. So it's the problem of the word. Then, linking it to Dr. Ambrosini's point, because the accreditation of organizations is dealt with in Section 24, rather than having a definition of accredited organization that says something on its own, if we need a definition, just refer to Section 24, Clause 24. And then in Clause 24, where you set out the detail of how and who, you can then provide for the bodies that we want done. There's no one's forgotten anything, I think, and there's general agreement that government organization may be too narrow, that we do want to be able to accredit a youth center or so on. But it's just a question of how, and I think the problem for me is the way they've got it now of using the word facility may not be the best way.
Okay.
I love that.
So I don't think the Section 24 in my perusal of it defines the organizations. It merely states what the minister has to do in order to define, to accredit an organization. So in my understanding, if a facility presents difficulties, what about institutions, government institutions? Will that make any difference? Because the Thuthuzela Center is, in my understanding, is an institution of some kind. Institution encompasses both the structures and the personnel, my understanding. Perhaps if you want to consider the use of the word institution. Because as I say, instead of Congregation 24 doesn't define. It assumes that an accredited organization has already been defined in the definitions clause. It merely states how this whole accreditation thing is supposed to be done. And it refers to organizations and not to, as defined.
First, the Honourable Steve Swart.
The original problem came in when the accredited organization seemed to exclude the inclusion of government institutions or facilities. And then DSD came when they were here and they said, we would like to be included, and the word we use is facilities. And I think that's, and there's a footnote on our previous drafting, the drafter's suggestion to clear any uncertainty that DSD facilities are also intended to provide services to adult victims. So I think that's a word, the word facilities is the word that is that DSD uses, the social development. So I think that is why it was included. Now that we're free to change that now again, but would it not bring uncertainty to social development that suggested the inclusion of that particular word to make it very clear that their facilities are included, and that seems to be what is used in their policy usage. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Jeffrey?
I think there's a difference between government facilities and DSD facilities. You know, DSD, Department of Social Development facilities, you know what they are. Government facilities, I mean, that's a playing field. And if they wanted DSD facilities, then why don't we then say including the facilities of national and provincial, might exclude others, but my worry is DSD
put facilities and institutions. Including the government facility or institution.
Wouldn't institution be? I get a sense that it might. That's better than facility.
Yeah.
And then perhaps I think Mr. Holomisa's got a point. I don't know whether Clause 24 lends itself to...
No, then I'm following Dr. Ormisa's emotions. then keep it as is. Accredited organization means an organization including a government institution. I'm still not convinced about institution, but maybe look and see if there's any other word. The thing from what Steve is saying, social development, we're asking about social development facilities. But if we limit it to that, there may be a metro of municipalities. Bodies. So you can't just say DSD facilities, but it's just a question of government facilities. It seems. Maybe I'm just on the wrong tangent. Thanks, Debbie.
So we leave both? Yes, Debbie Schaefer.
The issue of facilities, the running of the facility, obviously it's being run by the government, if we're saying it's a government facility. So the issue of being a structure is not really relevant, actually. If it's a government facility, the people running it are the government, and that is what we wanted it to incorporate, like DSD facilities. So I don't really see it actually is such an issue. And I mean, I don't have a problem with putting institutions or facilities, but I don't think facilities necessarily means only the structure, because it's a government facility, so it's defined by government.
Let's leave them both in. Facility or institution. Can it do any harm? In the definition.
Then the other, incorporate the other in any event.
I don't think we should put both.
No?
Institution encompasses the facility.
If the view of the committee is facility is fine, then we go along with it.
Oh.
No, seriously, I think institutions encompasses.
I thought it did, yes.
I think it does.
Government institution.
Mm-hmm.
Government institution. It's the word facility is unusual.
Facility immediate, it connotes in your mind.
In my mind, it's a container.
Establishment. Tribal court.
Institutions got another connotation.
Government institutions
got a very negative.
What's wrong with organ of state?
No.
Okay. The prison as opposed to correction facilities, what they use that for.
Oh, not a corrections institution.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Again, I don't know if we're going to find anything, but unfortunately state law advisors have left, but surely it's basically government speak that we're looking for, and surely that you can find a suitable word. You know what we want to describe.
Will the use of the word institution harm DSD to that extent? That's all we need clarity on.
Could list more like DSD facility, an institution of any other government department.
Okay. All right. I trust we've assisted you sufficiently.
Thank you. We'll give it some thought.
Yes, please.
If you could move on to page 8.
I'm on page 7. Raised an issue which I did not see either being footnoted or solved in respect of the combined reading of item F of exploitation relating to removal of body parts and the actual definition of removal of body parts. Now, this is removal of body parts from a victim of trafficking. There is no element there which relates to forceful or against the will. And the issue that I raised, as you may remember, was in respect of blood transfusions and voluntary removal of eggs or stem cells. which is something that happens. It may be suggested that whoever gives blood for money is ipso facto a victim of trafficking. And if it is, and many people do that as a way of living, it's an additional form of income. Or women who give their eggs, they are ipso for money, which is something that happens ordinarily.
Sperm donors,
yes, as well. So that's just clarity on that, whether we should not have an element of against their will, forced, or something of that nature, which is in the other aspect of exploitation. Sexual exploitation is an element of against their will. Servitude is an element against their will. Forced labor, forced, has got there. And the impregnation of a female person against their will, this is the only one where the element against her will, against his will, is not there.
Involuntary. Involuntary. I'm not sure it sounds against their will, forcefully. Or forcefully. Yes, that's right.
Thanks, Jay. Just something which comes to mind is that that speaks to removal of body parts, it speaks to organ or body parts. So the other things that we are referring to may fall under tissue or any other a different category. So, but I think that's something we'll look into, but...
Body parts are not defined.
Yeah, organ or body parts.
Not defined, yeah.
Is sperm a body part or tissue? It is a tissue. Tissue is body part? Okay. And so your blood is also a body part? Yes. Yes. Of what? Of the body part?
It's a part of the body.
Well, I don't think it's a part of the body.
What? What?
It's part of the body. It's an animal.
No. Are you saying spit is also not part of the body?
Yeah, because it can come out, it's not part of the body. And to me, part of the body is something that you can't remove.
So hair is not part of the body? You remove it. I mean, at some stage you remove it. Yeah, no, you do.
My point is that the hair is the body.
And it falls off. All right. Sorry, Chip. I don't remember this debate, but I think there's a what Dr. Amrassini's raised. But maybe this is something that we're going to have to look into. Maybe you're going to get clarification in the Tissue Act or one of those other pieces of legislation. So can we have a look at that?
Yeah.
Miss Williams is looking at it now, but...
Yeah, because there are people who sell their kidneys, and as Mr. Ambrosini says, who sell, donate their, what, they don't donate their blood, they sell it. Yes, they do. Really? No, it's not always. Street people, once they pick up where they can sell their blood, they go there regularly and have their... and get paid for it.
I mean, if I may... They give 5,000 rands for eggs in South Africa. Yes, 5,000 rands. The same eggs are sold in the States for $5,000. And that's the price differential. So, I mean, it's not for us in this piece of legislation to regulate this, but it is happening, and many of that is voluntary. I don't think we should... classify all those people who do it by virtue of economic necessity as victim of trafficking.
Yes,
thanks. Yeah, just to give some clarity, the National Health Act defines organ means any part of the human body adapted by its structure to perform any particular vital function, including the eye and its accessories, but does not include skin and appendages, flesh, bone, bone marrow, body fluid, blood, or gamete.
Okay. Take it back, Debbie. So it doesn't include spit and blood and sperm.
That's not body,
that's an organ.
That's an organ,
yeah. Yeah. Is there not something in the Human Tissue Act regarding body parts? The Human Tissue Act defines, let's see here, it defines blood, means human blood. It defines tissue, means any human tissue including any flesh, bone, organ, gland or body fluid, but excluding any blood or gamete. And tissue means any device or object implanted before the death of any person by medical practitioner or dentist into the body of such person. It doesn't define body part or organ.
I still think, can we go into it in further detail, and I think we need to do a bit of research.
Alright, just make a note there, honourable members, so that we're dealing with body parts, eh? Move our body parts. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, what did Dr. Ambrasini say about the G?
G?
The impregnation of a female person?
No, he says there, it says against her will. And that forceful aspect is not provided for in F. Man?
Thank you, G. If you could go on to page 8, the definition of immediate family member. You will see in footnote 10, this definition was included on the recommendation of the MPA, but the word search revealed that it is only used in clause 4, and the committee must decide whether this definition must remain.
Let's leave it now, then we can always take it out if it's only there, but we may add something. But my concern on this definition is that while it's clear in respect of the spouse, the civil partner, and life partner, when it comes to dependent family member, it's open, because there is no indication of what degree of kinship. So a family member could be 10 steps of kinship removed and would be still a family member. I mean, we all belong to the same family. And the only qualifying element is that of being dependent. So it could be very broad. I'm just wondering whether there's the intention to have it so broad.
If I can to add to Mr. Ambrosini's question, and I'm really posing this to members of the committee, Advocate Holomisa and Prof. Ndabandaba. Would a clan member fall into this category or definition?
Obviously, this definition excludes those.
It does exclude them.
Yes.
Okay.
And for instance, the head of a clan is responsible for all members of the clan, wherever they may be.
Okay.
I agree with Ngozi Lomisa.
All right, good.
I do think we need the definition in there, even though it's only used in one place, because we need that clarity as to who is an immediate family member, I think.
Maybe you could say an immediate clan or family member.
Cool.
No, that is reducing the...
Is it reducing
the scope? Yeah. If I say immediate clan member, okay. If you want to include the African definition of an extended family.
Yeah. Well, you see, the concern here is that once this person is accepted as a victim of trafficking, then their extended family get benefits. Hence my question. And that is where we are concerned, at the possible abuse that may arise.
And as you pointed out, Chair, the African definition of a family extends to members of the clan to which you belong.
We'll have to leave this definition here.
Yeah, I think it's safer, Chair, to leave it.
No, but the clan will cross the border because one of the members has been trafficked.
But I need to be the family.
Well, that's not hard to do. Well, he's looking after them by sending them across the border to South Africa.
Thank you. I just want to also state that in other legislation, when it comes to liability, they usually refer to the dependents, like say, for example, an accident, if you can show that it's a dependency on the person involved or the person who gets the benefits is extended to you, because that person is essentially responsible for your well-being to an extent. So when we look at this definition, immediate family member, they say it's provided for in Clause 4, and we look at Clause 4, it's basically to assist with the benefits, so the person who benefits or who's dependent on that member to benefit, but usually if that member is not responsible or people are not dependent on that person and that person gets some benefits, it's to exclude that. So usually legislation regarding liability would be only for the dependents of the person involved in the accident or the person who meets up with the accident.
All right. Yes, I think in light of the discussion, we must leave it there. Yes. Yes, it's precisely the issues we've been trying to conscientize you about and say, please understand the implications of this.
So should we not look at standing as a dependent?
Well,
Not to benefit from South Africa.
I think maybe we should ask the question, why should they be deprived if the person is a victim of trafficking of not joining their partner in the country? Because then the Congress would deprive him of that and the right to be with your partner and things like that. I think that already has certain rights. So that's why independent family members was added for that. But the spousal partner and things like that, they're seen as a unit together, two as a unit rather than two separate people.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, if you look at the offence of trafficking,
yes.
On page 14 of the document, where we refer to an immediate family member, that would mean that the means of the that was used by the trafficker, for example, the threat of force or fraud or deception, was aimed at an immediate family member. So it's not something to do with benefits or services.
I don't think we need to worry about that. There are no benefits going to that person. This is just for purposes of proving the crime.
All right. Are we happy, honourable members? Thank you for that.
Still on page 8, there is a definition of instrumentality of an offence that was also included on the recommendation by the NPA, that the committee must still decide on, and as well as still on page 8, the very last definition, proceeds of unlawful activities.
Yeah, I mentioned at the beginning of our briefing that the NPA has indicated that it's not going to proceed with that clause 30A, that poker-related one, declaration of forfeiture, and the definitions of instrumentality of offence and proceeds of unlawful activities on page 8, and I think there might be another one, are only linked to that clause. So what we're saying here is those provisions, those definitions can come out if we're not going to proceed with the declaration of forfeiture.
Are we not?
Cheno, I was feeling that the, I mean, maybe we deal with it when we go on to those sections, but I was not, as you know, happy with those sections. I thought the NPA was just sort of trying to widen the net as much as possible. I accused an official who used to be a human rights lawyer and who's now senior in the NPA of going sort of, what's it, due process, or what's the word for the people who are just into prosecuted or costs, and he denied that he had that it was him that was behind this.
But if you want to, or do you want to deal with it when we get there, I could just give, we did have discussions with the NPA, brief discussions on this, and as I said, they've said that we need not proceed with it. But the committee did say we must have a look at poker. Rather, if there's any need to amend anything, don't amend the bill, bring anything into the bill, but rather look at a possible amendment of poker. I think that was Mr. Jeffrey's suggestion. Anyway, we had a look at it, and the discussions, if I could just very briefly, it's dealt with in a quite a lengthy footnote under Clause 30A. POCA already makes provision for confiscation orders in Section 18. And a confiscation order, let me read Section 18. Section 18 of POCA reads, whenever a defendant is convicted of an offence, the court convicting the defendant may, on the application of the public prosecutor, inquire into any benefit which the defendant may have derived from that offence. And if the court finds that the defendant has so benefited, the court may, in addition to any punishment which it may impose in respect to the offence, make an order against the defendant for the payment to the state of any amount it considers appropriate, and the court may make further orders as it deems fit to ensure the effectiveness of that order. I think, and then Clause 23 says a confiscation order of court has the effect of a civil judgment of that court. So I think what was originally in the proposal of the NPA, Declaration of Forfeiture, which is also go to the state, is already in POCA. Mm-hmm. What the NPA was trying to achieve by putting something in here is exactly what is in POCA. I think the difficulty that the NPA have with POCA legislation, it says that Clause 18.5 says no application referred to in subject section 1 shall be made without the written authority of the NDPP. So there are procedures, extra procedures and things that need to go through. But what we as a department are saying is what they were trying to achieve can be achieved in existing provisions. And as I say, the NPA have said.
So they want to get around having to go via the NDPP.
Well, I'm not just sure whether that's the case, but that might be a problem.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the problem. So if it's there, why do we need it here?
Chair, my whole view was there were specific, and it was relating to some of the other sections, which hopefully relating to POCA and to POCA specifically. There are a number of provisions which are quite serious infringements of people's rights. In POCA, you can the prevention of POCA's corruption. Yes.
Okay. Prevention of organized crime. Yeah.
Not the POCA one in the corruption bill. It's the provisions for protecting if people have got unexplained wealth. PCC. I don't know if those are coming out of the recently. This. Remember, they wanted provisions if you had unexplained wealth from trafficking.
Featured, no, that, yeah, I think.
And it was more just that with corruption you can get wealth and nobody knows where you got it from, and therefore you might need those provisions. With trafficking, you've got a whole bunch of trafficked victims that can be detected, and you don't need those provisions. But anyway, it seems that's not covered.
The Honourable Debbie Schaefer. Yes, Dr. Rossini.
I'm afraid that regretfully the Honourable Jeffrey is right. I mean, POCA is the general piece of legislation, covers all cases. There's been negotiated analysis, it's been applied, there are mechanisms there. I don't think we need to create something new or trying to undo POCA just because there is another bill that is going through Parliament and reopen what was done there. We just need to refer to POCA and make it applicable to this type of crimes. Yeah, you're right. You don't need to. If it is organized, it is organized.
Yes, there's no need to refer to POCA at all. Yeah, it's on record. Dr. Ambrosini said you were right. Steve Swart?
Was there any motivation from the NPA as to why they wanted it inserted here? The whole debate we had was they were extending it. They were broadening the definitions and they were pushing the envelope, differing from the POCA legislation. Now, if it's back to the exact legislation, the POCA legislation, is there any reason why they want it here? And I don't see why it would be to their detriment, in fact, because then the whole testing, the jurisprudence, would then all be tested again in court, whilst the jurisprudence has already been established under POCA. So it would, I don't know if there's any, I don't know if there can be any rationale.
I tried to, and I haven't been able to get I really just couldn't come up with an answer, but while you were out, I mentioned that what's in POCA and clause in section 18 is confiscation order that you can get for a person can, and a confiscation order can be made against a person who commits an offence. And that confiscation order is really, it has the effect of a civil judgment. POCA says that. So what POCA does is the way I see it, is exactly the same as the provision that they proposed. What I did say, however, clause 18 says that a confiscation order may be made by a court on application of the prosecutor. But clause 18.5 says that an application by a prosecutor may only be made on the authority of the NDPP. And they haven't said it in so many words, but I'm just wondering whether that isn't one of the differences.
And your footnote, well, it's more like a page than a footnote, seeks to provide the answer, Mr. Swart. The reason why the NPA Asset Forfeiture Unit suggests inclusion of provisions seems to be to avoid elaborate provisions in POCA, for example, relating to application procedures, statements as to the value of proceeds of crime. The suggested clause proposes that the clause may declare property forfeited to the state in addition to any sentence imposed, making application procedures unnecessary, and so on and so forth. So it's the danger that Mr. Jeffrey is warning us about, that we need to be mindful that,
The other thing that was mentioned, we mentioned previously, the provision of the NPA that said that the assets are forfeited to the state, and it left it there. Benefit of POCA is how POCA provides for not only CORA, but it provides for the appointment of curators to take care of the property. If the property isn't cash, to liquidate them, to get the money, or to get the assets converted into money, and which will eventually land up in the CORA account. The provisions proposed by the NPA left it at the court can make an order that it be forfeited to the state, and then the question arises, who takes care of all the detail?
So in other words, the version
in front of us is not the same as POCA.
No.
And it hasn't been amended since we had our lengthy discussions with the NPA.
It's
sticking with their position, and then so we take the decision.
POCA. NPA has indicated that we need not proceed with their with those provisions. Clause 38.
No, when you were out collecting your snacks, the committee had suggested it be removed, actually. All right. So, well, they're not here. We don't care if they're happy or not. That's not the issue.
Now, I phoned the NPA just to get confirmation, and I spoke to them this morning in addition to the other times, and they've said we can leave it. It doesn't have to, we don't have to proceed with it.
Yes. Would it be appropriate to have a 5 minutes convenience break, comfort break, so that we can all feed at the same time?
Honourable members, can we agree that 30A comes out then?
Yeah.
For the reasons we've already given? All right, and then let's have a 10-minute break. 10-minute break.